Okay, we'll call to order the Monday, February 25th, 2013, Planning Commission meeting. Dave, would you please call the roll?
Yes. Chairman Christensen.
Here.
Commissioner Demarest.
Here.
Commissioner Dirksen. Commissioner Rodman.
Here.
Commissioner Sherwood.
Here.
Commissioner Tuttle.
Here.
Thank you, Dave. Okay, this is a time we set aside for members of the audience. If you have comments you would like to make that are not on tonight's agenda, you're welcome to come up to the microphone and give your name and address and go ahead and give your comments.
My name is Anique Bennett, and I'm with the Monroe Chamber and 108 East Main Street, number 206, Monroe. And I just want to thank you for the work that you've done. I know I've sat in one of the meetings, wish that I could have been at more, but I really did witness all the hard detail that you all had to go through to accomplish this task. And just to thank you on behalf of business, I know not a lot of folks have shown up, and I was saying to Bridget earlier, I really think that there's confidence, and so maybe that's a good sign. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Paul Lutz, 14869 Van Avenue, southeast of Monroe. I showed up because I just kind of disappeared so quickly, and I just wanted to come in and say hello. And I had been planning on leaving since about September, when our daughter started going to some extracurricular activities every Monday night very faithfully, and my wife would be home from work alone while I'm here, so... We only get 3 days off together every 4 weeks, so I thought, I think it's time to start staying home. But I wanted to finish out the year, and when I wasn't able to make it to the December meeting, and our daughter and son-in-law were in town, they were going to stay here through January, I thought I might as well just send my notice in now. So they're out of town again, so I just thought I'd come in and say hello. And it was nice to meet you all and to spend time with you and go over items and not always agree, but at least debate things, and I enjoyed it. So I just want to say thank you. I think I might be possibly coming back some more often and giving my opinion at times, but on this side instead. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. I would like to say for myself, thanks very much for giving me in this position. But no, I really like to say thank you for your service. It was a pleasure working with you. I thought you did an outstanding job as the chairman of the Planning Commission, and I learned a lot watching what you do and how you do it. Yeah, I really appreciate you being there. Dave, you had something you want to say?
Yeah, thank you. I'd like just like to add, Paul, I've seen more than a couple commissioners come and go, and you always were prepared, you always brought a balanced approach, and you always kept your cool, which I can't say that I have always managed to do.
Most of the time.
Anyway, I'll miss you here personally, and I know that the city loses by your leaving as well, but we certainly understand. Thank you.
My wife got off work a few minutes ago, so I'll see you.
Thanks, guys. Thanks again, Paul. Anybody else would like to have a comment? Okay. Next thing on the agenda is the approval of minutes for February 11th, I believe. Commissioner?
I make the motion we accept the minutes of February 11th.
Motion made by Commissioner Rodman. Second?
Second.
Seconded by Commissioner Sherwood. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman? On page 2 under the sign, it's design guidelines with respect to murals. Perhaps my recollection is wrong, but I thought we had, as a commission, come to consensus that murals would not be regulated by the sign code as long as they didn't contain advertising comment, and yet the minutes say that murals be prohibited. And I'm not sure that that's what we meant or where we want to go.
Now, I don't recall. Commissioners, you... Paul, do you recall?
I don't recall specifically. What we'll do is we'll check the tape to confirm exactly what was arrived at, if there was some point. But I was thinking that it was to prohibit, but only under the condition that existing murals are allowed and they would not be had to be removed at any time.
As I remember, this was the existing ones would be grandfathered in.
Right.
And the new ones would not be allowed. That's what I prefer.
I would certainly appreciate if we could revisit that to see what the tape shows us or tells us. I would think that this is probably going to be worthy of some further discussion. That's actually what we were understood to have said last time. Because there's a further concern, too, and that is, are we saying that a mural that exists today will have to be wiped off in 10 years? Which is what our grandfathering clause does say in the sign ordinance. So I think we need to be careful with that. In light of that, I would not be voting in favor of the motion to approve this at this point, and would prefer to see them withdrawn and tabled until we get clarification.
Okay.
Michael would call.
Okay.
The minutes, to have the minutes approved has been rescinded, so.
I see this as a bit of a catch-22, that if a mural's not a sign and it is not to be regulated under this ordinance, it would be regulated in some other way. But I agree, in retrospect, it should be clarified.
Okay, all right. So we'll hold off on approving the amendments until we get clarification on the mural thing. Thanks, Dave, for getting that. Okay, now we'll come to our public hearing. Our public hearing is on the Monroe Municipal Code Chapter 18.80 Sign Cone Amendment. And we'll have staff go through the introduction and what we're doing, where we're at. And then we'll open up the hearing for comments from the public.
I'd like to give a little bit of an overview and some specifics. We've been working on this sign code almost a year since we first started to talk about it last winter. And what we started with was some issues put together by the ad hoc sign committee, which is on the cover sheet. We talked about a number of things like video signs and off-premise and areas of signs and highway signs, various other smaller aspects of the sign code. And I think we've addressed pretty much each and every one of those, with the exception of landscaping, which is we brought up about landscaping that does not obscure sign. That's a different part of the code, and it's also part of the normal review process. But I think we've addressed these points, and what I wanted the commission to review with the commission, two things. One are the several issues that we've had quite a bit of discussion on and where they stand today, and the other is I'd like to go through this proposed table, and I can point out in certain places how it has changed from the existing, so that we have a better overall idea of really what has changed, what's been improved, what's gotten larger, what's gotten smaller, and location and so forth, as a fairly quick, but an overview of where we've been. But some specific things, some of the bigger issues, digital signs. We've restricted digital signs to general commercial, service commercial, and light industrial. But we also restricted them from any property that is visible from Lakeside Park, which would have to be a judgment on a parcel-by-parcel basis. We introduced the idea of off-premise signs for businesses that did not have that prime arterial front like Galaxy Theaters. I think we had a discussion about that. They're allowed in, I think, most every zone. Limited highway intersection signs, and what we focused on was the 522 West Main intersection interchange, not including the 522 Highway 2 intersection for larger highway, limited highway signs, as we did at Main Street, really in the interest of the automobile dealers. Sandwich signs, which are allowed, which we find almost everywhere, sandwich signs, were proposing that they be allowed in the downtown commercial zone and mixed-use zones, nowhere else. Murals, not allowed in any zone, except, and we'll check on this, except that the murals would be grandfathered and allowed to remain indefinitely. That would need to be, I guess, in the code, if that's the direction that we take, that we prohibit murals, that we can indefinitely protect those existing murals, so they're not subject to that 10-year fallout. In the mixed-use zones, we talked some about splitting mixed-use commercial and mixed-use neighborhood center. They are still together, but we did go back on this version as one of the changes that showed up in your packet to add freestanding signs in mixed-use commercial, the western zone, that would allow signs that are supported on poles or columns that that are a higher sign in that zone. The mixed-use neighborhood center does not have freestanding signs. And that was one significant change that we made since the last meeting. And we also added signage for LOSA, the Limited Open Space Airport. Somehow we overlooked that entire zone. So, you know, the airport would have been out there with no sign regulations. So we added that to the table and basically took a lot of the same criteria, regulations from the general commercial, service commercial zones to apply to the LOSA. Downtown North Kelsey, the downtown guidelines remain in place with the downtown master plans. The North Kelsey sign guidelines, you recall we went through last fall to the North Kelsey development plan and basically removed the land use guidelines and concepts and so forth since it was not developed in that form and therefore needed to be changed to reflect what's happening, what's happening in reality out there. But the sign code is still a part of those guidelines. The intent here is to delete, take action to change the North Kelsey guidelines, to delete the sign code, sign guidelines, once this new code is adopted, or maybe simultaneously with that. But the downtown guidelines do stay in place. And last item, just mentioning enforcement. You know, some of these changes are going to only be effective and be able to be implemented if we take some proactive enforcement. There's going to have to be a period of, say, 6 months or more for getting the word out and getting people educated and beginning to move toward complying with the code. But it will reach a point where we will start actively enforcing. I'm thinking of sandwich signs in particular, but other signs as well. We're just going to have to find the staff to make some effort to do that. Otherwise, these changes aren't going to really have that much of an effect. So it's going to be important to follow up this new, all these new regulations with some real enforcement. And there's some benefits to the new code. I mean, we're taking away sandwich signs, but we're also bringing back off-premise signs, which in the end are going to be much more effective than any clutter of signage that we have now. I think it will actually benefit businesses, that people will be able to focus on fewer signs that make much more sense. Any questions so far? Okay. What I'd like to do is run through this table, and I have gone through and tried to define the basic changes, or some of the more notable changes from the existing code, and that's why we gave you the existing tables as part of this packet, to this new code. In this one, on the first page, there are most of the first section didn't exist, and the second section didn't change. But on page two, one change to call out, the monument sign at the very bottom of the page is a new item in this table. In fact, the old code did not separately define monument signs. They were just included as a part of the freestanding sign regulations. So we have added that in this case, and one small change, the wall sign, which is about halfway down the column, is 40 square feet in this new code. Existing code is 80, it's twice the size. And in my mind, 80 square feet is too much for public zones for a wall sign. That's the only change on that page. Page three. The first two, window decals, both are opaque and transparent. The new code, there are 20%, cover 20% of each window area. In the current code, existing is 40%. The new code is 20%, which I think is a good idea. In my opinion, the window should be used to certainly advertise the business, but more importantly, to give people a look into the business, and as opposed to a blank wall, which is not very pedestrian friendly. So it has really cut back the available window area for window signage. Going down, the wall directory, N is the footnote, but the wall directory was not in the existing code, that's been added. And moving down to the very freestanding, greater than 200 feet of frontage, right here. Freestanding sign, two signs. The existing area for a single tenant is 48. That has been reduced to 32. So the single and the multi-tenant are the same, 32 square feet maximum.
Yeah. Paul, do we have a conflict in the language on the freestanding single tenant and also the freestanding multi-tenant, where we say number of signs is two, but in the comment we say up to four total signs?
Yes, we have a conflict. Per street frontage. That would be for having two street frontages, I believe. Only two signs per street frontage maximum on a multi-tenant.
Okay, so maybe just one of the words that I think perhaps
I have to clarify that.
Thank you.
A multi-tenant is 48 square feet, which is the same as the existing code.
Paul, thank you. I have a question also. When we're talking about walls, would that include an adjoining fence that's to the building? Or because you see, sometimes you'll see signs hanging on a fence, and I wonder where that would be covered. Is that considered a wall? or would that be considered something other than a wall?
Actually, that would be considered illegal.
Okay.
A wall sign is literally the for the building wall or walls, but there are not supposed to be any signs on the fences.
All right. Just wanted to clarify that. Thank you.
And again, the third and the bottom monument sign is a newly added sign in this new code. It's really not a monument sign in our existing. On the next page, on the downtown zone, we did suggest reducing the size of the sandwich boards from 12 square feet to 8, basically 2x4, 1/4 of a piece of plywood. 12 feet seemed just too much, and I don't know if I've ever seen any regular 3x4 foot sandwich signs. The next, the window signage, opaque and transparent, are at 20%. The current code allows for 25% in the downtown commercial. I think of a place like Discount Mattress, which has, in the past at least, it's better now, in the past has had a tremendous amount of coverage on their windows, which really starts to create a blank wall, which I don't think is very conducive to the shopping experience. Moving down, the blade in lieu of under awning is at 16 square feet. It used to be 10, so that's actually a little bit larger. There are several places where the number has changed slightly. If we go down to the wall single and wall multi-tenant, the single is 100 square feet as it is existing, but in the existing code, the multi-tenant is also 100. That's been bumped to 150 to reflect the larger size building. And again, the monument is something new. And in all of these, you know, the no mural, if it goes through as it is, applies. No roof signs would apply, which I didn't mention in the cover sheet. We have outlawed roof signs in all zones. And of course, the sandwich signs are limited in most zones.
For the monument off premise, clearly downtown extends beyond Main and Lewis back into the side streets. Would an off-site sign be limited to only those properties in the downtown zone that are not on Main or Lewis? Because I believe those would be collectors or arterials.
I think that's right. If you're not on Main Street or Lewis, it's the equivalent of being, say, on Kearney instead of Highway 2 up in North Kelsey. But there are businesses that might benefit from an off-premise downtown from within the downtown commercial district. But there's very limited space available. So it may not always be practical to have an off-premise sign for the off street downtown businesses, but I think it's good to at least have the opportunity.
And are our off-premise standards the same regardless of what zone they're placed in?
Yes, I believe so.
So if, say, a company wanted to do an off-premise sign that was down in the downtown commercial zone, not on Main or Lewis, and they wanted to do it down by, say, the intersection of 522 and West Main, these are the standards that would apply?
The off-premise sign is limited to the nearby arterial or collector. It has to be within the vicinity of the business.
So
it can't be on the other side of town.
Okay, I think that's good. So when we say adjacent arterial collector, would that be the closest arterial collector?
I guess it could be either, but the closest available arterial or collector would be where a business could place an off-premise sign if they go out of place.
And maybe I'm just getting some language here. Adjacent to me is next to the property, which would say to me that that property's on an arterial collector. Maybe adjacent is not the best choice of words in there, and it should say something to the effect of it shall be located on the closest arterial or collector. Am I the one who has a concern there? Brad, you're the engineer. Does that make sense to you?
Well, adjacent is usually means immediately abutting the property as opposed to, which then you want to eat it off from a sign because your sign would already be on the arterial.
That's kind of my thought.
Yeah.
Yes. So maybe a better choice of words could be found.
Yes.
Nearby. We'll clarify that.
Okay. Thank you.
Next page, use zones. The all these window and awning items are new to mixed use or not currently in the existing code. And moving down to the multi-tenant wall sign. Single is 100 square feet, maximum sign area. Existing is two-thirds of the tenant facade. So we've changed that to 150 square feet. To, you know, it's half again as large as a single tenant building, but it is a maximum number, never mind the size of your facade. I think this is easier to apply and interpret and enforce. And then the these last four rows, we brought in freestanding signs to be allowed in the mixed use commercial only, not mixed use neighborhood. And we pulled that somewhat from general commercial, but toned it down, I think, just a little bit. It's basically the same as professional office, those sign areas, 80 square feet for single and 120, having as much for the multi-tenant. Now, this is new. This was not in the proposed code before.
Yeah. Comment just on, and I touched on this before, the difference, I think, that is intended to exist and does exist between the MUC and the MUMC. And I want to pose the question, hope that maybe if we get any testimony this evening, there might be some response to this question on mine. Is the signage allotment, in particular the wall signage for the multi-use neighborhood commercial, it was from here downtown, too big? I feel it's pretty large. A multi-tenant building go 10 by 15 feet on the sign in this part of town for a wall sign. If there's some comment to be had on that, some feedback, I sure appreciate it.
Also, I think last time we talked about this, wasn't there something about the 522 West Main intersection having some special consideration?
That's coming up.
Oh, okay. The other question we had was, I know when we did the mixed use commercial and mixed use neighborhoods center, we had some sign stuff that was in the development plan at that time. Is that going to be, is this going to affect that plan? Do we have to go back and check the plan?
No, it shouldn't affect the plan. Those are more design guidelines.
Okay.
Mostly related to architectural, but if there's anything about signs in there, I don't recall specifically what was there, but it in the past has, it may assess the basic guidelines, but it defers to the municipal code for the actual regulation.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. I remember we did cover signs, though. Did you?
Just one other comment on mixed use neighborhood commercial. Changeable signs, changeable message signs are allowed the way this is written. And I, for one, I'm just not sure that we want changeable message signs down that part of town either. And again, if there's any comment that could come from the audience, and testimony, that should be helpful for me. Thank you.
Okay. Next page, general and service commercial. This also includes LOSA, Limited Open Space Airport. Just a few changes here. The first four, window and awning, are new. They were not in the existing code. As we come down to single tenant wall sign, about the, seventh or eighth piece down, 100 square feet. Let me find my place.
Next page.
Yeah, you're on the end of the page.
Thank you. That's better. Here we go. Single wall sign, single tenant wall sign, 200 square feet in the proposed code. The existing code is at 100. So that's quite a bit larger than existing. I'm sorry, it's at 300. This is quite a bit smaller. The single tenant is 100 square feet smaller. The multi-tenant is at 300 in both the proposed and the existing code. So the issue there was they were both the same for general commercial. And the thought is that a single tenant should not have as much of a sign area maximum, should have less sign area than a multi-tenant building for the total sign area allowed. So basically lowering the single tenant by 100 square feet from existing. And down under freestanding multi-tenant, where it's less than 400 square feet here, sign area proposed is 200. Existing code is 100. So it's half for the larger properties.
Okay. Same concern with size on the freestanding side. I'm not as worried about the wall signs. It's going to be a part of the architecture of the building. Mm-hmm. So again, if there's any comment from the audience that can help on that. I think back on our discussions about, and as far as I know, there's still nothing included with respect to ratio of sign area to total sign structure area. And if we're going to allow a 200 square foot freestanding sign, which is 10 by 20 practically speaking, along the Highway 2 corridor, for instance, or in the service commercial zone, and it could be 35 feet tall, all of a sudden, in my mind, we're starting to paint a lot of landscape with a freestanding side there, sign, especially if they're adding a couple feet on each side and across the top to get their structure included. And I think we just want to be careful with those sizes, both in the heights and also with that amount of square footage for a freestanding sign. So again, feedback that we might get would help me there.
That's a good point. And although one point to bear in mind is that that's a maximum for a single freestanding sign, but it's also subject to the site maximum. And down at the bottom, the total allowed of on-premise, off-premise, wall, and freestanding signs is 360 square feet. So it depends on where you want to put all of your, where you want to concentrate your signage. You can max out a freestanding sign, but it may not leave very much room for the wall signs.
So it's 160 feet still. 8 by 24 wall sign, if you max out the freestanding side on the single tenant site.
Good end. So that, something to think about. The freestanding off-premise sign is new. Of course, within the off-premise category, the up to 200 square feet, similar to the multi-tenant signage. We've added a changeable message for food in addition to the gas and the moving from the existing. And again, the monument sign, monument off-premise sign here is a new item in the table since they weren't in the old code. Now down at the total single tenant, total multi-tenant, current or proposed 360, current code is 300, slightly less. On the multi-tenant, it's at 480 in the proposed code. That was at 428 in existing code. I'm not sure where that number came from, but they're both of these numbers are slightly higher than existing code in terms of the grand total for each site. Any questions on that one? Okay, getting on to the end, industrial. Again, here there are no sandwich signs, there's no murals, no roof signs. Sandwich signs being the major change. A couple of things on the freestanding multi-tenant signs here. Those are at 150 square feet of sign area. Existing code is 100, so this is half again as large as the existing code. New monument sign, then, as before, down at the total, existing for both, well, existing is 300 for single tenant, and we've proposed 360. For multi-tenant, it's currently 300 square feet plus 32 square feet for each tenant over two. So if you had three or four or five or six tenants for each after two, you get 32 square feet more. And in this case, it's been simplified to a total of 488, which is a kind of a compromise between multiplying by a number of tenants as opposed to simply assigning an actual maximum. Then the last, I think it's almost the last page, limited duration, a couple of just quick things. These freestanding signs here for residential and commercial currently require a permit, and new code does not require a permit for those signs. And under the construction signs here for freestanding commercial residential, the current code allows, believe it or not, six signs for each. We're saying, I'm sorry. Where am I? Current code allows, yeah, six signs here. We're seeing one.
And we're wanting to require that builder or developer to go get a permit for that sign?
Yes.
4x8 sheet of plywood that's on a couple of posts?
For construction, it does remain for a permit. Ferris, does that need to be permitted?
For instance, Selden Construction is building the medical building up there right now. Has signage up advertising their company. And there's signage, I think, that's advertising the building that's being built. Did we permit those, or would we want to be permitting those?
I don't believe we did.
Seems to me we're asking for an awful lot of enforcement headaches there that the city probably doesn't really want. They are limited duration. They're not to be there permanently.
Of course, that would never be a problem taking out the requirement for a permit for the construction site.
I don't have any problem with that, but there's still going to be policing on size, so
right.
You know, you got that issue.
And last page.
Before we go on to that, if you don't mind, the residential sale rental, and I know that we addressed some of those real estate signs and the temporary signs, but as I read the definition, limited duration, it seems to me that an alarm put up in front of a house advertising that house for sale would fall into this category. And I think it would be a freestanding sign stuck in a hole in the front yard. And we're saying the city wants those permitted?
Oh, done under sale rental.
Yes, of residential properties.
No, we do not want to be permitting real estate signs. This... I'm thinking that the first box, residential lot, residential subdivision...
But look at the difference in the sign sizes that we're talking about. I think we're aiming at different places.
I think we need, we can check the definition, but I think we need to clarify just exactly what signs these categories are talking about, residential lot and subdivision versus residential sale and rental. Clarify that, and no, we do not want to be permitting listing signs. The, what do you call those?
Alarms.
Alarms.
Those.
We'll check on that.
And then the same gun that extended to the last box at the bottom on the commercial sale rental. The freestanding signs.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Last page. The shown signs are currently 9 square feet on this first item. We're saying 2x3 to be consistent with the other sandwich requirements for 6 square feet for both the open house and special event, basically limiting it to head on down, keep going on down the next couple of items under the special event. Oh, okay. Garage sale, special event, retail sale, and so forth. All of those at 2x3, 6 square feet. And under one point under the wall banner here, which is at 150 square feet, 24 foot height, existing to is 100, not 150. For a wall banner. So this is a bit larger, having it as a bit large. And that's for a, you know, that is a temporary sign. Those are, at least what I found in my search through the comparison of existing to proposed, what the changes are. And they brought up some good points about some things that need clarification. But that, this proposed code, for the most part, in terms of the detailed regulations, is pretty well carries over from the existing code, with the exceptions that I've noted here. So, to a large part, it is simply reorganization of the same regulations into a much better format, but not any deep change other than the issues we talked about early on with digital and sample and so forth, and these. A few places where we bumped up signs. So with that, I'll certainly take any other questions at this point and turn it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner, do you have any questions, Dave?
I've just got a couple more on my list, and my mind's not by any means made up on these. Again, I'm hoping to hear from members of the audience and certainly hoping to hear from other commissioners. I already touched on a concern that I have with regard to the 35-foot height. The murals, thank you for the comment on that and the fact that we look at that further. We talked about the murals as far as grandfathering and accepting them, but as I understand the way we're currently drafted, if we have a landmark sign, and I think of one, I think it's the Key Doloff Building, for instance, downstairs, I think that would fit under the definition of a landmark sign. We're saying that landmark signs have to be grandfathered and make conforming or go away in 10 years as well. And I don't think any of us want to create a code up here that causes the city to be in a position to say that landmark sign, that historical building built in 1902, needs to go away next year. So I think we want to clarify on that. In the residential section, the ID dwelling units, where would we have, when would we have an ID on a single family dwelling unit that was 12 square feet and not have any interest in permitting it or need to remove it? When does a house have a 12 square foot ID sign on? That might be 8 feet in high height. Or a freestanding sign that's 12 square feet in front of a dwelling unit of that size. I can't imagine. And so I need some clarification and help on that. And lastly, then, again, and I touched briefly on it, that whole question of ratios and whether we need to incorporate something that addresses that in our sign code. I know we've touched on it a number of times over the months. It's never been resolved. I think we've almost ran away from it quicker than we've run toward it. And I think we see some examples out there what happens when we have a sign become a very small part of the landmark that's now there. And I'm concerned about leaving that door open. So with that, I sure hope I hear from some fellow commissioners and also from the audience. Thank you very much.
Anybody else? Okay, then I'm going to open up the public hearing for public testimony. Do we have anybody signed up to give public testimony? Penny Bennett?
I spoke earlier.
Okay, all right. Is there anybody else that in the audience here that would like to give public testimony? Sir, would you come up please and give your name and address for the record?
Thank you. My name is Bob Martin. I live at 103 Rookmont Drive East in Monroe.
You can go ahead.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
You don't have to...
No oath or anything.
No oath anymore, no.
Okay. First of all, I'd like to commend the commission on the work you've done on this. I have personal experience in being through this a couple of times myself, and I know how difficult it is and contentious an issue it can be, and I think in general there's been a lot of good work done on this revision of the sign code. I do have a couple of questions and comments about what's in here, and my apologies for making comments this late in the game. I know what that's like. Yeah, having been through all the work that you've been through, then you get some guy coming up here and saying, well, why wasn't this brought up a couple of months ago? But nevertheless, I'm going to make a couple of comments. First is regarding murals. I personally don't see anything wrong with murals done the right way. I happen to have a building that I'm thinking about putting a mural on, and it's got a wall which I think would enhance not only the building but the city if we were to put the right kind of mural on it. And so I like murals, and I think they do a lot. They can do a lot for, I think, the Napa mural, for example. It's a very attractive thing, and I think it enhances the appearance of that building and that street, to be honest with you. So I would hate to see murals go away. And looking at the details of what you have in here, I did notice when I looked at the definition of murals, I believe that it's, which is on page 18, I think, wall mural artwork. That's kind of in direct conflict with the definition of sign. So if you read the definition of sign, which is 155, and then the definition of murals, which is 179, they are in direct conflict, I believe. So I think we need to decide what a mural is, whether it's an advertising, whether it includes advertising or not. I would like to see murals, a lot more murals, if they're not advertising, to be honest with you. So that's one comment. I do support the restrictions on sandwich signs. I think they've gotten way out of it. Nobody would argue, I don't think, that they've gotten way out of hand. And so I think that is good if we can enforce it. That's always a big question. I do have some concern about off-premises signs. I think philosophically, I think to allow somebody to put a sign away from their premise that advertises their business. They didn't really pay in paying for their property. They didn't really pay for the visibility of that sign, whereas the person that did does have a business in a highly visible area, in effect did pay for their area, and they don't have any benefit or any potential benefit from an off-premises sign, whereas somebody that is away from a heavily traveled area might gain, I think, an advantage that they didn't really pay for. A little bit of concern about the size of some of these signs. I know in our case, we have a building on Highway 2, and some of our signage has started to be blocked by other signs. And when we start having a bunch of big freestanding signs out near the frontage, it's sort of the last man standing almost kind of situation. And I guess I'm a little bit concerned about that. Let's see, I think I have one question. A couple of questions, actually. There seems to, talking about different frontages, different street frontages now. Fred Myers is a good example that has multiple street frontages. And I think the code here allows 200 feet for that kind of tenant per street frontage, but they would have a maximum of, if they're a single tenant, they have a maximum of under 400 feet. So is that really true? Is that really the intent, that they would be restricted to less than 200 feet per street frontage? So that's one question I had. And the other question, escapes me. So I think that's all I have. Appreciate your listening to my comments.
Well, thank you.
Dean? Bob, thanks for coming.
Yeah,
you bet. I'm going to ask you specifically, you said you commented on size. You're in the general commercial zone. Do you have an opinion as to a size that would be reasonable? And let me clarify, with regard to freestanding signs.
Yeah, I assumed that that's what you meant. So much depends on the particular circumstance, but our sign is about 60 square feet. Certainly it could be larger than that for a bigger business. It's 60 per square feet per side. Is that additive?
No.
So,
correct, Paul? Two-sided sign, you count the larger side. Look at the definition of sign, number 155. I'm sorry, 156.
Yeah, I don't.
The area of double-faced sign shall be the area of the larger single face.
Okay.
So it's, so you could have, some people could have a 300 square foot freestanding sign per side. 10 by 30, is that right? That's too big.
200 square feet.
Is it 200? Maybe I was looking at wall. I get confused on this stuff, but 200 square feet. I think probably 150 or some somewhat smaller number, but my concern is just one after another of these signs, and as you drive down Highway 2, your sign becomes progressively more blocked. So I don't know. Concerned about that biggest sign.
Thank you.
Anybody else have give for the public hearing? I don't see any hands. Entertain a motion to close the public testimony.
We'll close it.
Okay, Commissioner Rodman has moved that we close the testimony portion of the public hearing. Second?
Second.
Second by Commissioner Sherwood. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Okay, then we have some discussion on this. We can carry it further. Turn, Paul?
One item to note. Dave brought up the 35-foot height, which reminded me of the 5-pointed Main Street intersection signing, which is now at 45-foot height. We did reduce the size from 180 to 140 square feet. There may be some concerns about that height. What I'd like to do is, for the next session, I'd like to get a some information on just how, what the elevation of 522 is in relation to the adjoining properties. And I think 45 may not be unreasonable at all, but it'd be worth a look to see just how the highway relates to the ground here and what the difference between the highway is in order for a sign to be effective.
Dave? Paul, I lost that in here in our proposed version. I don't see it. Can you direct me to it? I know it was in the one that we looked at 2 weeks ago, but I can't find it. Maybe the numbers are all rounded together by this time, but
I know it's in here, but I've seen it. You know, it's in the sign examples. But it's actually not in the table.
It's not in the table anymore.
Yeah, it was.
So it should be included in the table as a, we can do within the, you know, it would apply for mixed use commercial and service commercial at that intersection, not allowing residential. But we would need to add that to the table as a supporting regulation of that sign example for those particular signs. You're right. Needs to be added.
Okay, so it's going to just be put back the way it was? Or? Okay.
And
go ahead, please.
I still have concerns over that height. Any further information you can bring with respect to the 45 feet height and the justification board in that one area, and also the, for me, as far as how the 35 foot height down the Highway 2 corridor, for instance, compares to everything we have. Just, I think that the comment that we got from Bob Martin about you lose sight of things because of the signage at some point, there's a lot of truth to that. We need to be careful. And we're talking about some pretty big signs at some pretty high levels. I mean, 35 feet is the height of a 3-story building. So that would certainly be helpful for me, Paul, if you can bring some information back on both those topics with respect to height.
Okay, our existing code does pretty much allow that 35-foot height. I'd be curious to know how many of those are actually out there.
I would too. Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment also on Bob brought the comment of murals and why they were not allowed. I don't remember exactly what happened and where they were not allowed, but I personally am with Bob as far as, you know, why wouldn't they be allowed as long as they don't contain advertising. Considered art, you know, that's outside the sign code to me. That's to my just personal opinion as a lay person. So I'm with Bob on that one. And Dave?
No, please, if you've got more to offer.
Okay, and then as far as the Bob's comment on off-premise signs, I agree if the off-premise sign is way out of their neighborhood or, you know, that type of thing. But I can understand, and we went through this, Bob, so that you understand. The off-premise signs, I think the last meeting we went through, we were talking about, you know, who owned the property, you know, where we were going to put the sign, and, you know, is it going to be shared by all of the people on that intersection or whatever, but that was discussed thoroughly, so...
That sure was.
So,
no doubt.
Yeah, but we tried to make sure that, you know, that the sign, the off-premise signs were covered as far as making sure that the property owners were, you know, taken into consideration. So.
Thanks.
Dave?
Going back to your comment on the murals, and I already offered some, but following up on the testimony we had with regard to the definition, we've got mural defined in definition 101, we've got wall mural or artwork defined in section 179, or definition 179, and they're the definition of mural is included in the wall mural or artwork definition, but then that takes it a step further, and I suspect we would find as time went by that it would just confuse things, and it seems to me that really we're talking about murals, we're talking about wall murals, and one definition should be able, in my mind, handle it and be adequate. 101's on page 12 of our draft ordinance, and 179's on page 18 of the draft ordinance.
There's some redundancy there.
Which I think in turn led to some confusion.
As I recall, we first started talking about murals, and some of the points were raised in terms of what is mural art and what constitutes a sign and how you separate those two. And I think in our code now, there is something about taking the area that's actually advertised, like the Napa on the Napa mural, and counting that as sign area. But it's not explicitly clear. Like is that then the rest of the mural would be exempted from regulation as a sign, but they're using, you know, 10 square feet or whatever, 5 square feet for that advertising portion, although the picture itself could be considered a sign. And really, good public art can make a tremendous sign without using it as text or saving anything, just as a signal to the observer, just like that Napa mural. But the question becomes, you know, whether we do choose to allow murals, and you know, we won't regulate content that they would need to apply for a permit, and we would do a review based to see if there's anything that is inappropriate. I'm not sure how you define that, but obviously inappropriate. That should not be done, as opposed to if I don't like it, if I don't like the color, why, that's not my, that's my position to say.
Yeah.
I can't regulate taste.
Yeah.
Well, you say that on a mural, and I'm completely supportive of the murals, and I'm even concerned with if we have a mural that is really historical in content, that we're trying to regulate a part of it as a sign, and I'm thinking of the Napa example. Because really that is a historical depiction there of what Napa looked like in probably 1955. But you said we would permit murals. There's nothing in our code that talks about us at this point that I see permitting murals. Even whether in the, as in they're allowed or as in the process that they have to get a permit for it. And so I think that we need to get that in here somehow, somewhere. Unless it's going to be in some other part of our code, and I don't think that makes any sense. again, I think that a mural that's art, the salmon in the stream on the side of the Hill Street, no, the flooring store across from Napa, clearly is not an advertising medium. The Napa, in my mind, is historical. It's a depiction of some time in the past. And then you could certainly have a mural that would clearly be intended to advertise today. And I think that's where you cross over the line. How we define that, I look to you. Well, thank you.
Commissioners? Any other discussion?
In general?
On this public hearing?
Yes. I would sure appreciate hearing some thoughts from the commissioners on the chamber message signs in the mixed-use neighborhood commercial. Could be up to 32 feet in size, if I remember right, on a wall sign. Or actually, could be 100 feet in size if the building allowed it. Down here in the mixed-use neighborhood commercial.
But we fit message signs are limited to 50% of the eligible area. If you have 100, then I guess that message sign would be limited to 50 maximum.
And I know it says that in the downtown zone, it doesn't say anything about changeable messages signed in the MUNC or MUC zone. And yet when we look at the 1881-100, it says the changeable message signs are allowed in all zones, or allowed on any sign as part of any sign. So I'm not sure that restriction carries over to that zone, Paul. And 1881-100 starts on page 26. So if it's not addressed in the table under a zone, it seems to me that we would look to the language of the ordinance with regard to changing message signs, and that would be the controlling criteria, would it not?
The code would be, if it's in written form in the code and it conflicts with the table, I would take the code language as the overriding requirement. Okay. I'm trying to flip through here. In the table, public zones and office allow changeable message signs at 50% of the allowable sign area. Downtown,
I don't believe it.
50%.
And I take back my comment about the wall sign. They're only allowed on the freestanding side for the ordinance. So it'd be up to a 32-foot sign that could be a changeable message in the mixed-use neighborhood commercial.
Actually, I don't see changeable message signs in mixed-use zones in the table.
So by not being listed in, they are not allowed? Because if we look at 1881-100, Section A, changeable copy may be utilized on any permitted freestanding pole, pylon, or monument sign, etc.
That would mean what it says.
It could go.
Yes.
So then I would go back to the commissioners to say, is that what we want to have through this part of town? Which is rather historic in nature and more like a professional office, certainly not like a commercial zone. There's residential uses in there, there's office uses.
I think it's an oversight one way or another with mixed use, since the other zones do have a line item for changeable message signs. My guess is it was inadvertently left out of mixed use.
And then that may well be, but if we're going to adopt an ordinance and come back and review it a year, it'll be a little later, two or three of those signs have gone in that zone, we decide then we don't like it.
I guess you could apply the same question to historic downtown. Historic Main, the core of the downtown area, as opposed to the outlying parts of downtown commercial.
That would work.
Except there's no freestanding signs downtown, are there? Except there are, there's multi-tenant signs and the monuments.
Right. Table signs are allowed. I think Key Bank has one, isn't that? Mm-hmm. Union Bank.
I thought the last meeting you just eliminated the ability to put digital signage in the MUNC and the MUC, and changeable message the MDs and the MCs were allowed. I thought that's what we left at the last meeting.
But. And we did remove video from mixed use.
Well, I'm the only one that has a concern, and I'm ready to move on.
Question?
Yes.
Have we ever had any people come in for the variances or the appeals section of this ordinance in 1880-170? Have anybody ever changed any of the ordinance? Or come back to the planning commission over the years?
You know, a variance would actually go to the hearing examiner, but I don't believe there have been any variances for signage.
Okay.
It would be unusual to have a signage variance of any merit.
I'm not going to go through my list again. I can't believe that no one either has an opinion on some of this stuff or disagrees with my opinion and isn't willing to say so. I'm one voice up here, but boy, I sure feel lonely being the only voice. So I'll stop.
Commissioner?
Well, I'll say, Dave, you've been on here longer than most of us and know what's going on in detail, so I do agree with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Well, first, I'd like to say I agree as far as on the this multiple mixed use area of Main Street here.
The mixed use neighborhood commercial?
Yes, I'm having the, making sure that we allow changeable message signs that's already in the table. Is that part of what you're talking about, is allowing that?
I'm suggesting that in that mixed use neighborhood commercial, which tends to be truly mixed use residential, some offices, and historic in nature, that we not allow.
Okay, that's what I thought you were talking about. And I agree with that. With that part. So changeable message signs.
I think I'm okay with changeable message signs as long as they're not video, and I think we took care of that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if the chiropractor wants to say, get your back cracked for $39.99 this week, I don't see a problem with that. But I do see a problem with get your back cracked $39.99, get your back cracked $39.99. You know, I agree with that, and I think that's the intent you're getting at. But limiting someone's ability to change their message when they're trying to do business, I am against that.
Okay, as long as changeable message could be, I guess, interpreted in different ways, now that I'm thinking about it. Changeable message could be, you know, one day I go up I put the letters up that says one thing, and next day I go up and put the letters up that says another thing. I mean, that's brought up here in the general insurance commercial as far as gas, food, movie, whatever. But it doesn't designate that in a mixed-use commercial. It just says changeable message. So if we're talking about a digitized sign, you know, that can change, you know, and flash and blink and scroll and all that type of thing, that can become a distraction and unsightly in a mixed-use commercial.
I thought we had already prohibited that by saying that, you know, video signs, and we may be getting into semantics and definitions.
Yeah.
Changeable message says the definition can be either hand changed or electronically changed.
Okay.
But my understanding is that it's a fairly constant message rather than one that's flashing like you would see on Route 2.
Constantly changing more than once every 8 seconds.
Well, I think we've already made it clear that type of sign we don't want in the one you're talking about. And if we have to do something to make sure that is put in the code or in the table, then we need to do it. But I understand, you know, what you're talking about.
Okay, and on 22, number 22, changeable copy sign, I remember going over this now. Yeah, changeable copy sign and changeable message center sign. And so in the table, it doesn't really say whether it's a changeable copy sign, changeable message center sign, or both, or whatever. But a changeable copy sign means a sign or portion thereof which copy or symbols change either automatically through electrical or electronic means, such as time and temperature, or replacement of letters and symbols, you know, hand change. And then changeable message center signs is controlled public service time and temperature sign, message center electronically controlled, a reader board, different copy changes, public service commercial media are shown in the same sign surface. That would be, in my mind, that would be what I would not want to see on Main Street. The changeable copy sign, as long as it's, you know, within reason, I don't see any problem.
I think my sense is we agree it just has to be memorialized in a clear way.
Paul, are you following?
Yes, I think there's some confusion here between what exactly, show me a picture of a changeable copy sign as opposed to a changing message center sign. They're very similar in the definitions.
Yes.
But the table uses a different term. It calls for changeable message sign. So the question becomes, which one is it?
What is it? Both. As I read that, I see the changeable message center sign as being a much broader definition than the changeable copy sign. And perhaps the definitions together need to be revisited and looked at to see what it is exactly we're talking about, allowing or not allowing. I would think the gas station sign would be more of a changeable copy sign. They have prices of gas, and they may have time and temperature, perhaps. The changeable message sign could be the one up in front of, or part of what's in front of Alfie's, not Alfie's, they're updating myself, Tierra's, where they have messages that come up, stay for presumably 8, 10, 12 seconds, and then change their content into something else. And it may be commercial nature, maybe public information. I think that's what our code is saying could be allowed down there, and I think there's a concern and confusion. And part of what we're trying to accomplish through this process, as I understood it, and if I go back to the purpose behind this effort was to clarify our code to make your job, Paul, Brad, and everyone else on the staff's part, easier and make the coordinates more predictable and understandable for the public. This sort of stuff is not helping toward that end.
Agreed.
And there may be more that we'll find as we go on. But I'll get some clarification on the changeable message, and then we'll have a clearer basis as to some direction on where they may be restricted.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it. I appreciate everyone's comments too. Thank you.
I think, Paul, part of that may be defining the duration, so that one of these definitions says you can't change the content of the sign more than once every 24 hours, something like that, so that it doesn't become, you know, something that flashes right. And is distracting and is out of place with the neighborhood that Dave's talking about.
Well, I would be adverse to like time, temperature, you know,
right.
Like a bank has time, temperature. It's not, you know, distracting.
The only concern I have with it, Matt Stone, is it might be next door to someone's house who's trying to live down there, sleep down there, and hear this red sign is blowing on their house all night long.
Yep. Okay. Anything else?
Just in terms of action tonight, what we're suggesting or asking for is that the public hearing be continued so we can keep the record open. Because we have thought we need to go back and do a SEPA determination for this sign code, and we need to go complete that process and go through the mailing and comment periods before the commission takes action in terms of a recommendation. So what we'd like to do is bring this back on March 25th to keep the record open until then, and then close the record at that point, and we'll present findings, conclusions, and maybe resurrect some of these points we've talked about here tonight for specific action by the commission on these recommendations for council. And we plan to go to council in the first part of April.
Okay, so we just continue the public hearing until March 25th, and we wouldn't be able to close
this. And the motion says, you know, direct staff to prepare findings, conclusions. Yes. In other words, take the final steps toward the recommendations, and we'll provide the determinations, findings, and conclusions, and everything will be done then in conformance with the requirements of the process for this code amendment. This is a development regulation that does trigger the SEPA review, which is what we're going through now.
Okay, but the recommendation action on here says March 11th.
It does, and
you're saying
it
March
should be
25th.
The 25th because of the comment period will still be active on March 11th by about a day or two. So, okay, we thought it best to really complete that cycle before we bring it back.
Commissioner Demarest?
Paul, there have been a number of items brought up that we're going to seek clarification on. You're going to bring some more input on. Would that be happening then at the same meeting in which we would be looking at approving already drafted findings and conclusions?
Good point. Well, what I would suggest is that we bring back these points for clarification at the next meeting, which is March 11th. We have a Roosevelt Road rezoning public hearing that's coming back on the 11th. I guess we should continue the public hearing to March 11th to keep the record open. Not date specific, but or we could, I'm not sure what the exact process should be. We could continue to March 11th and then vote at that meeting. We arrive at final decisions on these items and then continue it to March 25th for final action.
Can I take my take?
I think that makes sense to me rather than trying to do it all in one meeting.
Yeah.
I think that's a good plan, Paul.
Okay. Do we need a motion to continue the meeting?
Okay. Public hearing.
The public hearing? Okay.
And I move that we continue the public hearing to March 11th.
I'll second that.
Okay, we have a motion by Commissioner Sherwood to continue the public hearing to March 11th, seconded by Commissioner Demarest. The discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. And do we need the motion to direct staff, or we do that next meeting?
We can do that next week.
Okay.
Next
time. All
right. In the meantime, we'll be working on it.
Okay. Next thing on the agenda then is the
bike
workshop. And the workshop is on sanitary sewer service outside the city limits. Brad's doing the presentation.
Hopefully, when I shut the lid on the computer, it'll go away. Yes, it is.
Back to business here. Brad?
Yes. Thank you, sir.
Good evening.
Excuse me. The New Municipal Code section 13.08.240 currently allows this provision of sanitary sewer service outside city limits at the discretion of the council if the developer who wants the sewer meets several conditions, such as following city development standards, paying city mitigation fees, and things like that. There was a court case in 2007 against the city of Renton that said that you cannot condition the provision of sewer services on city regulations. They get to develop with the regulations from the jurisdiction in which they develop. At that time, the city council was presented with the possibility of allowing sewer service outside city limits or prohibiting sewer service outside city limits. The city council chose to adopt an interim emergency ordinance that prohibited the provision of sanitary sewer service outside the city limits. That interim emergency ordinance was extended twice and expired in October 22nd of 2010, when it was not extended and no permanent regulations were put in place. Therefore, the current regulations we have are the ones similar to the type that were overturned in the case of Renton. So I was looking through things and noticed that was updated, that needed to be updated, and also we've tried to annex things outside city limits and have been turned down by the voters who live in that area. substantially since we only got 6% of affirmative vote to annex up in the northwest corner of the UGA. So that presents a conundrum to the city of that the basis of GMA and the way the population forecasts have divvied up, the city of Monroe is supposed to accept a certain amount of population inside their urban growth area. And if we don't provide sewer service outside city limits and developments come along, and we've actually had a couple of those developments happen up between just to the west of the Robin Hood area, past the fairgrounds, that the person comes to the city, they say, city, will you provide a sewer? The city writes a letter and says, no, sewer service is not provided outside city limits. They can then go to the county and develop at larger than urban densities that are shown by the county in that area. So instead of building on 9,600 square foot lots, which is zoned in the county, they have to build on whatever size lots will allow them to do septic tanks, which is usually somewhere between 12,500 square feet and 15,000 square feet. So the effect of that is to lead the city to not be able to meet those population forecasts for the urban growth area, which will either require an expansion of the urban growth area, which is sort of contrary to the Growth Management Act, it's trying to increase densities and prohibit sprawl, or we're going to have to increase the densities in the areas with inside city limits. One way to avoid that is to allow for the provision of sanitary sewer service outside city limits within the urban growth area, since it's against state law to provide sanitary sewer service outside the urban growth area. And then that will allow the people who own property to develop at the density that is zoned currently within Snohomish County, in unincorporated Snohomish County. For example, the Roosevelt Ridge area is currently zoned R7200, which will allow for 7,200 square foot lots, which is about twice as many or half the size of lot that would be required if they were on septic systems. The area to the east of Monroe up Ingram Road is zoned in the county 9,600 square foot lots, but they want to be able to build on those if without sewer service, they have to build bigger lots. So the city, we took this to the city council. The city council thought it was appropriate at this time to investigate the provision of sanitary sewer service outside city limits, but within the urban growth area, and directed staff to return to them with a proposed ordinance at their April 16th meeting. Because this is could be construed to be a land use development regulation due to a court growth management hearing board's decision on the sewer service regulations in the city of Sultan. Our city attorney thought that it was best to follow the GMA process, which pre-existed the planning commission for your perusal, and also to conduct a public hearing, which we have scheduled for March 25th. This year, after which you'll be able to make recommendations and findings and conclusions of the city council at your April 8th meeting for them to consider at their April 16th meeting. Do you have any questions yet, or should I keep going? And I think I'll cover some of Mr. Demarest's questions if I just keep going.
How about it?
Okay. This is kind of one of those wild arm waving planning kind of things, that there's several definitions of things and sometimes they get confusing. If you look at the cover sheet that I provided you down at the bottom of the first page, it talks about there's a couple of really short paragraphs, and the third paragraph up there starts the currently adopted sewer system plan. In 2010 there were 9,267 ERUs connected to the wastewater treatment plant. That number is based on the amount of water that was consumed by customers currently connected to the sewer service, so the sanitary sewer system, which is different than the amount of water that actually gets to the wastewater treatment plant. We'll euphemistically call it water.
What water?
Yeah. No, I say we'll euphemistically call it water, or we can call it stuff. You know, it's more than just water that makes it there. In 2012, the flow that actually made it to the wastewater treatment plant is equivalent to 12,515 ERUs. So that takes into account rainwater that makes it in their leaky pipes and things like that. So it's actually larger than the amount of water that is actually consumed by the houses that are connected to the sewer system. So that's sometimes why there's different numbers, and there can be the water that's used by the customers versus the stuff that actually makes it to the wastewater treatment plant. So you'll see some different numbers. So even though the sewer system plan says there's 9,267 ERUs connected to the sewer system, there's more ERUs worth of fluid that is making it to the treatment plant, which is actually 12,515 based on the average annual flow to the treatment plant. That's important because you have to keep that in mind when you're saying, okay, we have lots of room for this many more houses to hook up, but you have to take into account the other flow that's actually going into the treatment plant.
Brad?
Yes.
Could you tell me what an ERU?
Oh, equivalent residential unit.
Okay. Thank you.
So for the sanitary sewer system plan, that is considered to be 130 gallons per day. So you take the total flow that goes to the treatment plant, divided by 130, that's how many equivalent residential units are making it to the plant. So according to the draft buildable land survey that is almost final with Snohomish County, they are, in 2011, we had, based on both residential and commercial or employment-based ERUs, we had 8,433 ERUs connected to the wastewater treatment plant. But our flow is approximately 12,000. So the difference between connected ERUs and what actually makes it to the treatment plant is about 1.5 times as much. So in 2035, which is what the current projections we're using on for the upcoming comprehensive plan update, there's going to be a total of 11,601 equivalent residential units connected to the wastewater treatment plant. So if you multiply that times the 1.5 that we're currently using to account for inflow and infiltration, which is called INI, that comes to 17,400 ERUs of flow coming to the wastewater treatment plant. The current, okay, yes, sir.
So is the number in here, the 23,524, is that the maximum capacity of the existing wastewater treatment facility?
No.
What
the existing? I was just going to say that. Okay. So in 2035, the flow expected to the treatment plant is 17,401 ERUs, and the existing capacity of the treatment, or the existing capacity of the treatment plant in about 2 months will be 17,530. So currently there is capacity in the wastewater treatment plant for the 2035 population projections for the entire UGA. And that's assuming that something like a large brewery doesn't show up that uses 5 million gallons of water a day. But the way things are planned to go right now, we have sufficient capacity at the treatment plant for the proposed population and employment forecast up through 2035.
So what does the 23,524 represent?
That is the total build-out. That is if everybody in the city and the UGA at maximum density hooked up to the sewer.
And we have the capacity for that?
No. Not at the moment. I mean, our wastewater treatment plant says, sanitary system plan says that, you know, this is what our capacity is right now, and we will have to expand our treatment plant sometime in the future as more growth develops. But right now, we have enough to fit our population projections for 2035.
So you'd roughly have to double the capacity. If you take 23,524 times 1.5,
mm-hmm.
that would come out to about double what the current capacity is.
Correct. For flow, yes. And then this is also based on flow. There's three measures of capacity in the wastewater treatment plant. There's the hydraulics, which is the flow. The other one is total suspended solids, and the other is biological oxygen demand of the waste materials. And the flow is the limiting one, because right now we have a flow capacity of 17,500 ERUs. The BOD capacity is 34,000 ERUs, and the total suspended solids is 33,000 ERUs. So we just have to put bigger pipes in the plant, but the most of the treatment processes are big enough to do that entire amount.
Why the disconnect?
It's the way treatment plants work. Yeah, it's easier to build big tanks, but we can get the big pipe, the big pipe, so.
Is most of our stormwater going through the sewer line?
Not most of it. All the new stuff that's been developed, you know, since the 80s has separate systems. So down the downtown areas that we, our Fremont Street project that we're working on right now will remove a bunch. And we have done a couple other projects as they're getting around to it, as doing separating out the stormwater from the sanitary sewer system. And the project on Hill Street that we did removed all of that area from the sanitary sewer system because it used to go there. So,
Dave? So from, and I think everyone knows I don't live in the city, but I do own two properties in town here. So I'm a taxpayer and potentially a utility payer. From the utility customer's perspective, over a 10-year horizon, is faster expansion of the use of the facility good for the consumer, for the customer, or is it going to ultimately cost the customer more?
I wouldn't say it was good for them, but it's not bad for them, and it should not increase their costs.
But it will potentially bring about sooner expansion, will it not?
It depends on how you think about sooner. You know, if it, the expansion will be required when we get within 70% of our 17,000 ERU capacity. So whether that occurs from inside the city limits growth or outside the city limits growth, I mean, that doesn't matter where it comes from, that's when we have to do it. But the connection fees we collect from new customers are there to provide for that expansion.
So those connection fees would be specifically identified for future capacity issues versus ongoing maintenance and upgrades of the existing
system? It's not accounted for that way, but that is the intent of those. It's in the last rate study we did, it's an accounting method of doing that, but it's taken into account that the capital fees that we receive from those people are used for the expansion of the plant. And whether the actual money itself is put aside and never touched, it's kind of a flow-through approach from the accounting system, so that the money is taken, is accounted for to be there, but if someone pays us today, we're not going to just take that money and hold it. We're going to, you know, do the repairs or now, and then the money that the people who are paying rates now is a portion of that each year is set aside to the capital fund.
Is the sewer rates outside the city limits going to be higher than the city limits?
Yes. Our current ordinance calls, except for the Evergreen District Court, the Sheriff's Office, which isn't there anymore, and the Evergreen State Fairgrounds, which pays 1.5 times as much, everybody else will pay, has a 2 times rate multiplier.
Okay. So I have one of my rental houses. Their current utility bills, water, sewer, and garbage, currently is running about $325 a month.
Okay.
So a similar house outside of town, they'd be looking at $600 plus in utility?
Well, you can't, I mean, there's
given water,
depends on where they get their water from. If they got water from the city of Monroe, their water would be 1.5 times as much. And then their sewer bill would be 2 times as much. And then, I don't know what, how the garbage rates outside city limits compare with inside.
It doesn't do much toward the affordability spectrum of housing, does it?
Better off annexing than you are not annexing.
Yeah.
Thanks, Brad.
I have some other questions when it's time.
Okay.
You might answer them.
I think I'm done with everything I wanted to say.
I have a question. Brad, you were here on the staff years ago when we had the Snohomish County tomorrow and before the growth management act came into effect. And they wanted us to designate a growth area, which we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we also hired a consultant who designed a sewer system in this area, which ended up to be all of Roosevelt, all Robin Hood, Lake, yeah, Wood Creek.
Wagner Lake.
We had a sewer system designed that went halfway to Salt on the old Owen Road, and boy, did we catch hell. Do you remember that? is that, do we still have that sewer system plan that we paid for?
No. No, I'm only, we've done probably three since then. and currently the sanitary sewer service area that's in the sanitary sewer system plan is the current urban growth area.
Okay.
Because since we're not allowed to provide sewer service outside the urban growth area, therefore we felt it wasn't appropriate to plan for it.
Now with this new system, this is going to be off, but the school up there in the Chain Lake, is that going to be ever hooked up to our sewer?
No.
No. Okay.
Well, I don't know. Ever. But not under the proposal because it's not under the other.
So what is the justification to the multipliers outside the city limits? If they are required, by what I've read, to pay for all of the infrastructure to get from the end of the existing lines to whatever their needs are, why the multipliers?
The rate multiplier is determined or is supposedly for the work that is done by the city that is paid for by taxpayers in the city that adds value to the waste, the system that is not provided by people who live outside the city limits.
But they're paying connection fees and monthly fees.
Right. And then that's why they pay for the fees outside are higher because they don't pay directly for police protection of the wastewater treatment plant, whereas taxpayers do. Because that's part of the general government of the city. So that's why they pay higher rates rather than their property taxes going towards that.
It sounds a little thin, but okay.
Hey, Brad, I'm looking at the comprehensive plan map right now, which is, I think, a current map. Our zoning map, by the way, still needs to get updated on here. It's out of date.
Quick point.
And we talked about that a couple weeks ago.
Right? The current zoning map is on the web, and it hasn't been. We sent the wrong map last time.
Oh, it's still wrong on here. The ones that are saved on the desktop.
Saved on the desktop?
Well, there's a folder that has city maps.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. So, I guess we really don't care about things like the developments, if we're talking about Roosevelt Ridge area, the developments connection, for instance, to Robin Lane and the city road, because it's all an incorporated area. It's the county that gets to deal with all those issues.
Correct.
So, I guess my main question then comes down to, well, twofold. One, I think everyone seemed to have a sense that that annexation request up there was going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And it did so in even a greater way than we expected. Aren't there other ways that they could look at annexing to the city?
There are, but annexations are always subject to a vote if there is a protest.
So the
neighborhood signs a petition and says we want to vote on this. And I'm assuming if they got 94% of the vote, they can get the appropriate numbers to require an election.
Thank you. what sort of precedence does it set for this future? I mean, we've got other areas that are in today's UGA granted smaller that someone might choose to develop this way without annexing. And presumably we're going to have at some point in the future an expansion of the UGA. And it seems, well, it seems that from everything I'm hearing from you guys, we're going to run out of space and we're going to have to expand the UGA at some point. And I know that we've got these, what they call the rural transition areas that kind of buffer around our existing UGA that are designated for future expansion of the UGA. What's it mean to this city long term if more of these UGA areas were to choose to develop under county regulations and forego annexation? Is that a bad precedence, to start down?
Not in my opinion.
Just because of the dollars?
Because, yeah, we don't have to provide the infrastructure maintenance, no stormwater, you know, no road maintenance. We get the income from more people shopping in Monroe, so there's increased sales tax. So, you know.
Well, you mentioned stormwater, and that stuff runs downhill.
Yeah.
It'll end up in the city eventually.
Yeah, eventually. It depends on which mirrors, where the growth is at, because you can bypass both ways. So.
And I just lost my thought. Is there someone else that wants to step in?
Yeah, I have a question about the, once the infrastructure is in place outside the city limits but within the UGA, who is the onus on to make sure that that continues to function properly?
City of Monroe. Basically, we have an enterprise fund for the utility, so basically it's like a standalone utility company, so it'd just be like, you know, PUD for electricity.
Okay, so the hookup fees and the ongoing fees, there's something set aside to make sure that that infrastructure, just like that, within the city limits,
correct,
all operating as it should.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
And I caught my thought. And maybe it's, and some might laugh at this perhaps, but it goes to that whole concept of community. And I listen to what we're talking about here, and I think of Maze Pond. Maze Pond, Jeff, you probably know where it's at. It was outside of Bothell, North Bothell, and Snohomish County. There were other areas that developed down there outside of the city limits because sewer was readily available, made available. And ultimately, those communities became a part of the city. And the city inherited whatever the county had allowed to happen down there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, too, you know, we've heard it before in these council chambers here, well, you're not a part of the city. Well, I live up on the hill, I pay you sewer and water utility fees, and I shop in your town, I spend my sales tax dollars here, I feel like I'm a part of the city, and yet they're not. And I just, it's kind of that soft sort of subjective sort of thing, but I just wonder if it is really ultimately going to be good for the city of Monroe as a community goes, and also the long-term effect of ultimately probably those areas will get annexed into the city because the votes will change.
Right.
And those people will want to come into the city.
Commissioner Rondo?
Yes. That development in the county, Dave, is going to, it's like Robinson Park. It has no sewers in it, has no sidewalk, no curbs. If it was to be annexed, you'd have to go in and tear up the whole street system, and it would cost a fortune for those people. If you're going to develop under the county, if, in our urban growth area, we better have all of our regulations and have the sewer in and the sidewalks, curbs, the whole bit put in with city standards. Otherwise, we're going to have the same problem with Robin.
Well, but that's the point. Wayne, we're being told that under the law out of Renton in 2007 or 8, that can't happen. The city cannot dictate or stipulate those sorts of improvements. Yeah. It's entirely up to the county, which has the jurisdiction. And I suspect in a 7,200 square foot development, they will require curb, gutter, and sidewalk.
Well, they require a vote of the people. I call it the anti-growth people. Because they didn't want to annex areas, and that all took place after the growth of the act.
Brad, didn't I read in here something that, as part of any agreement to provide utilities, the development standards would have to be approved by the city?
No. Now, that's the current code, which is unenforceable.
So, Jeff, in your opinion, having experience both now in the city and, of course, in the county, do you see that there would be exposure to the city of, you know, some problems because of the difference in development regulations under those densities, under county ordinance versus city ordinance?
The design standards for the roads and that type of infrastructure, developmental lots, will be all under county code. And they definitely are not the same as any of the 20 cities. And this has been a battle that's been going on between cities, the city and the county, ever since GMA came into play. What's happening right now is the county is making it so difficult to plat property in the urban growth area or outside the urban growth area that developers are now looking inside the city limits to make their bring their lots on board. That property is starting to expire. In order to get the density they need to build at an affordable rate, they're looking to the urban growth areas where they can attach to the sewer system. The sewer is what allows them to build at a higher density inside the urban growth area. So it's a catch-22. Either you provide sewer and allow for the urban density to come on board, which supports the city's population allocation, or you ignore the urban growth area and allow it to build out at 12,500, you know, quarter-acre lots under the rural cluster subdivision code that typically will come on board through the county processes. And then you'll never annex those people, because they're on septic systems, they're on a water district, they're providing deputy services, they're happy out in the real world. It'll never happen. What's going to happen over time is you're going to end up with a hybrid. The urban growth area is going to get developed at a hybrid between city sewer, our city sewer standards, but everything else is built in county, but at a density closer to the city's comp plan.
So if you were on inside the city limits and then you went across the line, you had a subdivision across the line developed to county standards at 7,200, and you did the same thing inside the city limits, and I went out there, would I see a difference, a physical difference? Streets, sidewalks, lighting, all those things?
Yes.
Do you think that county side would be more or less desirable than what you would see inside the city?
I honestly can't tell you that, Jeff. You know, that's views and I
have over.
A lot of it's going to have to do with how close the development is to a school, because that, you know, then kicks in the whole safe walking and all the rest. Typically what I've seen in the county plats that have been approved, curb gutter, sidewalk, lights, the whole thing, they're required inside the urban growth area, typically now with the county. And truthfully, developers are building flats that way because that's the way the home buyer wants to see the neighborhood
look. That's what they expect.
Right.
So you just said that the county was making it very difficult for flats like this to get developed. What's the philosophy behind that?
To be quite honest, I've never figured that one out. It's raw just land to house is going to take you 48 months, whether, you know, you rush it through or, you know, that's just the process.
And inside the city limits, what's that time frame? 18?
Six. Quite a bit faster than
that. 18?
Yeah. It depends on how fast we get the results. Sorry about that.
Jeff?
Yeah. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was going to ask you a question. Now, to go back to the annexation part of this, where the problem was all began, how would you go back to the hearing examiner of the county, like we used to annex between the cities and the county, rather than to go through the vote of the people?
So the boundary review board?
Yep. Used to be that way.
You know, I'm not an expert on the annexation law. It's changed so much over the last couple of years.
Brad knows.
Yeah. No, I mean, like I mentioned earlier, is that even if it is by the assessed value method or something like that, there is the ability for the people to petition for an election.
Yeah. It used to be 60% of the people who could...
60% of the assessed value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there are property owners up in the Roosevelt Ridge annexation area that desperately wanted into the city just so that they could build out at city densities instead of county densities. The problem is, you know, they're just one vote on 5 acres, and, you know, the other 92 people voted against those 6 people that had developable land. And then there's builders or developers that own substantial tracts up there that had no vote in the process. And I think what you're going to see if we do this sewer extension, that allows for that raw land or those larger tracts to come together and do the petition method and ask to be annexed into the city. Even if it's developed at outside with city sewer at county standards, but then that annexation could come in with those lots. So I don't know. I think it's a good idea to do this. I think the pros outweigh the cons in extending sewer outside the urban growth area.
Jeff, does that opinion still hold if you take the economics out of it?
Well, in truth be told, I never liked the different fee structure, and that's something council's going to have to determine. I think part of that, and this is supposition on my part, but the higher fee outside is an annexation encouragement clause. You know, if you want to be part of the city, you know, pay normal rates, vote to, you know, become part of the city. And I think there's some truth to that.
Paul? You know, I'm thinking that the county, at least in terms of its comprehensive plan policies and so forth, would most likely support this extension of sanitary sewer. In this case, since there is very little or no chance of annexation for Roosevelt Ridge, in order to avoid the alternative, the lower density development of the urban growth area, which should be developed as it's intended, as a higher density, as an urban density, hopefully with urban improvements. But I see this as a means of supporting what we are obligated to do as a city is to absorb, accommodate that growth with the targets that are going to be, like Bryce said, are very close to final iteration and all of the numbers. So I see this as a positive alternative to simply letting that land develop at a lower density than we need to accommodate.
Dave? So we've heard about ERUs out of the buildable lands study. What is our shortfall projected at this point?
Right now, all the houses that are currently there plus the buildable lands, whatever you call it, the capacity, there's a total of 25,031 people. And the buildable lands calls for 25,157 in 2035.
So we've got a shortfall of a couple hundred?
142 people.
So it has changed dramatically.
Yeah, 142 people, and you divide that by 3, that's, you know, less than 50 houses.
We gained on closing that gap, and this coupled with the projections are lower than they were 5 years ago.
Yeah, they went down by 1,450 houses. So,
is there any other urban growth area that could be annexed in that really wants to come into the city? Other than that area?
I mean, there's more outside. There's some stuff along Ingram Road, but no one's indicated any interest in annexing.
Seems to me that if the annexation process that exists stays in place, then having urban growth areas outside the city limits becomes moot. In that they're not going to come in any case
And so you have the status quo, and pretty soon you're going to see six-story apartment buildings in downtown Monroe to get your density like they have on the Denny Regrade in Seattle, right? I mean, that's the only alternative. And so I agree that if we're going to meet our obligations, we really have to look seriously at this issue.
They have to go to Olympia. Olympia has to do something. Their growth management act is what they're going to have to do.
Yeah.
They started it, but didn't fix it.
And you see that in Edmonds, Mill Creek, Linwood, Mount Lake Terrace, Bothell. There's a hole right in the middle and some very established, built-out, wealthy neighborhoods that refuse to be part of any city. They won't allow themselves to be annexed. And it creates undue amount of stress on the county services, providing police services to donut holes. It's really an expensive proposition for, in the county, it's not obligated to provide urban level services. They're not designed, they don't have a sewer system, they don't have a water system. It doesn't make sense. So annexation law and the whole theory behind urban growth areas type, the annexation is supporting infill and density. The annexation law right now kind of precludes, unless you're expanding urban growth in areas into large tracts of unpopulated area.
Is there a provision in the county process that the city gets input on design issues because of the location of a property within the UGA?
I think we could probably comment on all the plats, and that's completely
just to encourage consistency.
Yeah. I mean, we get notification for comments from things that are far outside the urban growth area, so.
Chairman, if we think this is going to go, we didn't extend, so.
Okay.
It's falling off there.
Sign off.
Yeah. Make the motion.
I move we extend the meeting past 9 o'clock.
I'll second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Commissioner Sherwood to extend the meeting past 9 o'clock and is seconded by Commissioner Demarest. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Paul, I think or maybe Brad in your introduction said that this was sort of a land use action.
Yes.
Which is why it's in front of us.
It's in front of you, yeah.
Are there any public notice requirements involved in this, and how would that be accomplished?
Yeah, you're having a public hearing on the 25th of March, so the notice is in the newspaper next
Tuesday. And so it'll just be sort of a generic notice saying
and
the planning commission's holding it.
On press left.
To discuss an option and ordinance regarding the
extension. If you look at the third attachment that I think was passed out today, it was late coming, is actually the proposed changes to the municipal code, which basically the big section that talks about all the requirements, just as lately, it says the service area is the urban growth area, and then a couple sections down, it clarifies who pays for and how you ask for an extension of sewer. So
I just can't help but reflect back on when we talked about this area in the past, we had such a strong turnout from non-city residents.
Right.
It's almost like they're not going to really be told it's just going to happen. And next thing they'll know, there's a land use application up on the property and for 7,200 square foot lots, and they'll be down here yelling bloody murder, being told, hey, go talk to the county.
Yeah. Okay. And that's not to stop the county from creating that tighter zoning too once sewer's out there. So
to doing what?
Put in a tighter zoning inside the urban growth area. They may create a higher density.
They could go to multifamily.
They could.
That's a little scary, isn't it?
Well, the city would there has to be a consistency there, and that's a wrestling match that will take place, but typically it won't happen, but it could happen.
Because we've got it designated for 5 to 7 on our comp plan,
there's got to be consistency between our plan and their zoning.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that area right now is zoned, or proposed zoning, 6,000 square foot lots inside city limits.
And the county has its own 7,200, which would make it compliant without a comp plan designation.
Yeah.
Something like multifamily would trigger comprehensive plan amendment process to the county.
The county would have to go through that process too. So
no mean feat.
I think I'm having a density problem here. I still don't understand how we as a city can say we're going to put sewers into your area and you have to pay for it.
No, we're not saying that. We're saying if you want sewer, we'll let you buy it from us.
Oh, it's not forced upon.
No, the city's not doing anything. Yeah,
it's kind of way that it reads though. You know, it's like we're going to expand into that area.
30 years down the road, if those properties that are on quarter acre lots and their septic systems fail, and the sewer lines run right down their street to the next development, the health district may theoretically say,
okay,
you have to connect to the sewer.
That I can understand. Okay, but I was, in my mind, you know, I'm not as up on everything as some of the people here at this table are on these things. But in my mind, the way I was seeing it was we were pushing it out there. And I guess that's where I was mistaken.
We don't even make people hook up inside city limits. So.
Yeah, but understand where I'm coming from. That's what I was seeing. That's what I thought I was hearing.
No, we make it available for them. We don't.
Okay. All right. No, I'm straight.
Yeah.
I'm cool.
And if somebody's out there wants to develop a higher, you know, bigger lots, that's between them and the county.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Dave, Brad, when we talked briefly at the break, you said that the city does get traffic mitigation out of the development by the UGA.
Yes.
But it's a prorated amount?
I didn't know you were going to ask that question, so I didn't bring this up. There is an interlocal agreement for reciprocal traffic mitigation fees between the county and the city.
I remember something.
And it's basically donuts around the city. The farther away from the city, the lower percentage you pay. And so I'm not sure exactly what it is in that area. I was thinking it was 75%.
Well, certainly 75% of the traffic would probably come down.
Right.
Say, 179th and into town. Though it does have a good connection to the highway once they get onto Robin Lane. Mm-hmm. No parks, mitigation.
And it's not to the city, no.
And certainly, I'm sure this would have an impact on, say, Lake Tai and other city larger parks.
But impact fees are, I mean, remember those are for capital, for expansion of park facilities, not for maintenance.
Well, and certainly, you know, the city can use more money for capacity or capital improvements. No question about that. Well, it seems the county, or the council rather, has already, they've said they want this, as I understand.
They said bring back an ordinance.
An ordinance supporting.
Yes.
So I guess the next task for staff is to bring us an ordinance, right?
Basically, you have it. I mean, that's the code changes. It doesn't have anywhere it has this in it, but that's the proposed code changes.
Okay. Do we have to have a public hearing on this?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Commissioners, any more discussion on this tonight?
Oh, yeah.
So, I do have a question. So, Brad, in this document, and it's multiple pages, really all the stricken language, and is there inserted text?
The first line of section 240 is inserted text, and I think it's 280 has the rest of the requirements for who pays for what.
295.
Okay. And that's the only two sections that changed.
Thank you.
Has there been a calculation of the population increment that potentially exists between the city limits and the UGA?
Yes. Well, maybe.
There have been projections based on an assumed build-out density. for there is in the UGA, yes.
And does that increment meet our obligations? You said that the buildable lands report makes it look like we're pretty close. Assuming there aren't too many critical areas or things like that.
It's a combination of the capacity and the resultant density. But it does account for critical areas as non-buildable.
It does take out the critical areas, right. Yeah.
It's part of the capacity formula.
Anything else? Okay, thanks, Brad.
You're welcome.
Discussion by commissioners and the staff. A couple things.
We did today receive from Department of Ecology approval of a conditional use permit for the Cable Park. It is subject to any federal regulations, and there's a question of core involvement in that, but we did receive that today. The council granted the substantial development permit, and the Ecology was the granting authority for the conditional use permit. For that. And the other point, the other item on our search for a planning position, we did get about 30 applications, and we're now in the process of sifting them down to five or six to take the next step, and I'm hoping to have some interviews arranged by the middle of next month, middle of March, and try and get somebody on board as quickly as possible after that. We got some good applications.
Yeah, that's
cool. A lot of interest.
Jeff, do you have anything?
You might have all saw that the red light camera decision came out today.
No.
And the city, or the Court of Appeals reversed the Superior Court and found in favor of the city. Dismissed no legal fees, no slap. Basically indicated that the initiative process is not allowed on this particular issue, and so the city came out on top of that. So, it's in the Herald and it's in the Monitor right now. If you go to the Court of Appeals, you can get a copy of the decision. Pretty clear cut.
Do you remember how much more time we have with it on the contract?
I believe it expires. Well, I know it expires this year, but I've yet to see the contract, so I don't know. Brad may have seen it.
What's Tim Levin going to say about that?
Who cares?
He's got an initiative that he's filing right now, or it's an initiative to the legislature, 517, that allows, that opens up the playing field for local initiatives. And I mean, it's really a push towards pure democracy.
Is there a hearing on the Walmart set yet? Is there
no.
No date yet?
Check every morning.
Watch.
We did file a request for expedited review, so we're hoping we'll get that April document.
Brad, did you have anything else?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Tunnel?
No, thank you.
So, Paul, is that a go on the Cable Park then, or was there a caveat from the state?
Well, it's basically a go. There was some discussion about some feedback from the Corps, or some kind of ruling from the Corps, and whether there's any further work to be done with that, and consultants and the applicant are trying to work that out with the court so that there won't be any more delays.
There is a 21-day appeal period to the Shoreline Hearings Board, and so we can't really do anything until we clear that hurdle, right?
Well, they can't start construction until after that's over.
They can start pulling permits.
Yeah, they've submitted some permit applications. So
there was no appeal action on the substantial development permit, so there may not be any similar action for the conditional use permit either.
When will they, when's the projected opening if they don't start for 21 more days?
As soon as possible.
Wow. They were talking about July 1st.
Wow.
It's like 3 weeks later than originally intended.
Could be June 1st. It all depends on how fast they can get the building up once permits are issued.
Any news on our vacancy? Any more applicants? Any action?
No, the listing closed last Friday. That's, see, now we're
no, you mean here on the
planning commission?
Oh, no, not that I know of. We need some recruiting. We need to do some collective recruiting.
Yes. Okay, I do have just one thing. I'm still on the Parks Board, so I still go to the meetings for the park. I heard something interesting at the last meeting. They're looking at an area over at Tye Park, taking one of the ballpark fields, if possible, because they're having three baseball fields put up, or three fields put up at the high school. Eventually, it'll be three. And then they're going to try and use one of them at the Tye Park to put in a music, like a band shell type thing over at Tye Park, so they could put on music events and that type of thing. So it sounded real interesting. It's still in the planning stage right now, but because you have to figure out parking. Where are you going to have more parking if you're going to have these types of events? But that's some of the things that are being discussed in the parks thing.
Question on that for me.
Yes.
Is the city going to revisit the alcohol in the parks?
I haven't heard anything. It's permitted now.
Oh, is it? That did change.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. So with a special events permit. Special events permit.
You can't wander around with your beer bottle. It has to be a special event.
Well, I'm certain lots of other cities do that. They have their little beer garden, and it works very well. And I think it probably is almost a prerequisite for some sorts of...
And for the concert in September, that's the plan, is to have a beer and wine garden.
There you go.
Lock. And then I was sorry that we lost Jeff Rasmussen as a Parks Board member. I thought that Jeff did a great job and was sincere in his efforts and commitment to the community.
Yeah, we lost Jeff. Jeff is no longer part of the Parks Board. But that's all I had. So I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
I'll make the move. Wayne got it.
Motion by Commissioner Rodman to adjourn. Do we have a second?
Second.
We have a second by Commissioner Sherwood.
Yeah.
Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Goodbye.
I'm not trying to rush you.